what was the fatality or illness rate that you would attribute directly to COVID during this period of time among homeless folks? Any sense of that?
A very, very small, maybe 1 or 2%, and that's a guesstimate. Of the people that I came in contact with during all this period, I only knew 3 people that got the bug. Nobody that got killed, but 3 people that had the COVID, and they managed to survive, which was very satisfying.
How many people would you say that you come into contact with on a regular basis get other illnesses that lay them low who are homeless?
Well, that wouldn't be the COVID. That would just be all the different things.
Flu, cancer, you name it.
I have people that have that. I have people that have with problems with HIV. People that don't have they're not having an immune system that makes you exposed to
indeed,
so much.
But during the same period that these 3 people who got COVID, you noted, how many would you say you noted got other illnesses?
There are some, people have their aches and pains. I mean,
what's your estimate?
I don't know. I couldn't give that a number. I wouldn't.
I'm trying to talk about the vulnerability people outside to illness compared to.
Well, they're sleeping outside. It's cold outside, and they get wet in the rain. Like most of us, we just climb inside the house and stay warm. We can go inside and we can take a shower if we after a day of running around doing this and that. And when you don't have access to all these different facilities. To stay hygienically clean and
indeed,
healthy and
indeed.
Whatnot, it goes and makes you more at risk for different illnesses.
Looking at it from another perspective, how many people in the last 3 years of the COVID pendency who are not homeless, who are your colleagues, your friends, just your business associates, would you say got ill, that you became aware of that had COVID?
Maybe a half dozen.
And would you say that's because, but you regularly have at least as much association with unhoused people as you do with housed people. Is that fair to say or not?
Yes.
And so in effect, it seems those who are unhoused seem to be more, and this was the case, by the way, in Santa Cruz too, I think, less susceptible to a COVID illness and more susceptible, those who are housed.
Well, that's great that it was like that, because we don't want people to be taken out early because this virus is floating around and nails you, and because you are weak or not as strong as if you were living inside and warm and everything else, and healthy and eating healthy food and all the other things that you need to
but
stay healthy.
But you found
healthy.
That was true, though.
Yes.
You think, yeah.
Yes.
Now, I guess I initially had the thought that, well, the people you're handling money for are those who have in essence been declared either. The Social Security system required them to, in essence, find evidence that they were disabled. I've been concerned about this because recently, and I also asked you regarding the issue of whether there were religious requirements to have your services, that is to say, to have your food services, your whatever other clothing and other things you present to folks on, or the street service opportunities, street spirit opportunities. I was assuming you don't make this is there's no religious requirement to do this.
Well, there is a religious requirement to do this. We must care about those people around us, not just the people that are blood
you
related.
You say, hold it. I'm not going to feed you unless you care about other people. Is that what you're telling me? You say
you've
got to read this book for here's the Bible. You got to read. I don't think you're saying
you
that.
You need to care about everybody, not just the people that are nice or wonderful.
Are you requiring that to get food services? Is my question, and you have not been answered. I mean, I know you the answer, but I just want you to answer.
Well, since we've been out there for such a long time, people know that we're going to be out there with the resources that we bring out and many different types of resources.
Regardless of their views, regardless of their willingness to perform services, regardless of how much they love their fellow human being. Is that correct?
Well, sometimes there's a lot of distraction as far as the love part. There's a lot of anger out there.
You're not answering my question, JC.
They don't have the wonderful things that we
Why
have.
Are you ducking the question? I don't understand. No, it seems to me a simple question. The answer is, no, we don't require you to do anything to get the food. We would love you for you to care about other people. We urge you
no,
to do
we
that.
We don't require them to do anything. We bring it out to them because they have a need
I assume
to,
that's
eat,
the case.
To take care of the different resources that are out there and make sure that it is redistributed by people that have those excess resources that can go and flow it out and we're happy to be part of that distribution.
That's
and it's
good.
Not distribution of resource, it's the distribution of care.
Of course, the distribution of resources compared to the actual excess resources is, you would certainly agree, minuscule.
Well, the whole thing, it's a package deal. You give out personal resources, the moments, the time that you can give out, and whether it's food or clothing or when you can find housing for them through the different subsidized housing agencies, we have this responsibility to take care of one another.
Would you agree that the actual resources available in Berkeley, a wealthy community in part, certainly, far exceeds what actually is being distributed to those who need it in Berkeley?
Well, what's out there is good. There's never going to be quite enough to take care of everybody, and moving from a homeless situation to a house situation is a giant step if you've been out there and homeless for a long period of time. You can't just step back into a housing situation. It's something I've been experiencing
for a long time.
Are
you telling me the existing situation, the existing wealth in Berkeley, if it were fairly distributed, would not serve the people who are currently in need here adequately?
Well, it's going to take more than housing. It's going to take the additional emphasis of care beyond just the housing.
But it would probably take the housing as well.
Yes, of course it would take that as well.
It's available, you're saying, but it's not being used.
Well, the amount that's available, but it's limited to some degree. And to have your apartment and have your own bathroom and your own kitchen, I mean, that's great. But if you're just stuck in like a tiny house where it doesn't necessarily have the same depth, sometimes it's just not enough, especially if when you were younger, you were exposed to having all of these luxuries, if you follow me.
Necessities.
Yes.
Of course. So I guess, see, what I'm saying is that, and I'm not trying to demean or limit or suggest that what you're doing is, it is inadequate, obviously, to meet the need, and it's that is because of the fact that resources are hoarded, increasingly by those in power and those in the upper class, in my view. You may not share that view. I don't think all Catholics do. Some do, I think. But I don't know what the story is with you. But I guess in Berkeley, I guess what I really want to ask you, I might want to ask you now is how things are going in Berkeley after this COVID. What has been the change in the situation here in terms of how people are treated? We've known they've demolished some of the encampments without providing lots of alternatives. Some alternatives were provided in order to get people to lure people out of People's Park. You know, they set up this 3-year hotel thing, I believe, or maybe it's a 1.5-year hotel thing, I'm not sure. But what's your sense about the impact of the end of COVID here for homeless folks or for folks outside?
Well, the need to take care of one another continues whether we have COVID, whether we have homelessness, whether we have illness, whether we have we don't worry about situations such as the cost of everything going up to the roof. We still need to take care of one another, and that should be part of the way we take care of ourselves. When we get together and we have kids, we take care of our children. And once the kids get to be in their 20s or 30s, then we have to send them through high school and into college, if we can do that, and help them make that next step further along in their lives. But to do this for people that we're not related to, that we choose to take the responsibility of those people that nobody has enough time or effort or money to take care of, trying to get society to see the depth of responsibility we have for everybody, not just the people that we are in love with and that we are tight with. The need is always going to be out there, and the important thing is that we do respond to that need.
Do you find people responding more, less, about the same over the course, let's say, of the last 5 years?
Well, because of the COVID, it sort of shook up things and made things difficult. But I think it's allowed more people to see there's some great needs that need to be addressed, and I'm happy to be part of that, and I'm very happy that over the last just 2 or 3 years, it's picked up a lot, and we have more people that are sort of chiming in and saying, well, let's get involved with this, let's get involved with that. And it just it doesn't have to be in our group. It's just that all of society needs to be taking care of all of society rather than just their own tight people that they're tight and connected with, because we have to take care of one another. It's the whole world. It's not just our little group.
Have you seen an increase in this recently, a decrease, pretty much still the same? What's your sense?
The increase as far as the response, I think that's definitely what's been happening. And the need is keeps growing and growing. If we have this problem with our climate change that's coming up and around the corner here, and we have different problems with the cold weather and the hot weather and the winds and all the different things that could perhaps come along.
The occasional nuclear war.
Yes. Well, we have to take care of one another, because there is much more to it than just the time that we spend down here on Earth. So if we do the good things for ourselves, when we finally make that break from life to death, we want to make sure that's a positive transaction.
So your theory presupposes a life after death. And for those who wouldn't believe in a life after death, there would seem to be little motivation to engage in this kind of human love unless they had some other reason to do it.
Well, we try to take care of them even after they're gone.
What do you mean by that?
Well, pray for them. Remember them. And as use that as an example to teach others to step forward and to care for one another. So very important that we do that.
Now, are you suggesting that taking care of someone after they're gone by praying for them and suggesting that other people remember them and follow their example is helpful to a person once they're gone?
Yes, I do.
And how would that be the case?
By so many different ways it's done. Not just what you pray for them, but the fact you take that energy that you can't do for those people that are gone, take the energy and the resources that you have, and you take that forward and you help the people that have not reached that point of where they're about ready to pass on.
But how does that help the people who are gone?
Well,
I mean, it helps other people. It helps you. But how does it help the people who have left?
Because there's the transition between life and death and the afterlife. And if you understand that to a better degree, it starts to click.
So you have a personal experience with this transition?
Yes. Well, I lost my son here 2 years ago. He was only 32 years of age. And I could have chosen, do more than that, that he was gone. Well, yes, he was gone. But where or what is happening to him? Is he just when he got killed by getting hit by a car? Was that it? Was that just the end of the story? No, because something goes on beyond just the fact of life when you go into the death, because your soul, that stuff that's within you, not the physical stuff, but the emphasis of divinity within you, needs to pick up. And if he wasn't ready to make the final jump, if you follow me, then he needs help from us, and we work on it. And we pray for him, and we do good, and basically move those brownie points forward into his situation. And as I look at it, if we do that and we're successful, when he gets there, I think you understand what I mean by there, hopefully he'll be up there when it's my turn to go up there. He'll be standing there at the gate and say, hey, come on in.
So, in other words, again, you are suggesting that your own, it's hard to talk about your experience yourself. It's hard for me to comment on your experience grappling with the reality of someone very close to you who has died, particularly prematurely, particularly someone you've loved and spent years and years with. That is something that it seems inappropriate even for me to even mention this. Because I talk in abstractions, and abstractions are not what this person was or is to you. That's not, the person is far from an abstraction.
Well, if you had had a child, or you had adopted somebody, or took on a great responsibility for another person, then you would perhaps see that, because you'd have that constant focus of things
right.
That needed to be done.
But I am talking about, this is something that people experience, that death, as a natural course of part of life. and it happens to all of us. And so that's why I ask you about your personal experience when you talk about it. It benefits other people that you pray for them. It benefits them, not just you, but them. And your suggestion, I guess, is this based simply on a series of beliefs that people have an afterlife, that they are waiting in some heavenly area? Is it based upon that solely, or is there something else? Because many of us don't share those beliefs, as you know. Are there other reasons, other feelings you have, other aspects you would say that it benefits this person? In other words, I advise you, Robert, when someone dies you really care about, that you pray for them or that somebody else pray for them, because that's going to benefit them. That is to say, them, not being the person who's praying, but the person who died.
Yes,
and this is
right.
A very technical question for you.
Yes, that's right. That does have a great emphasis on it. And it can, at the very least, it could change the way that you are and what you do personally for yourself by extending out that depth of love that you carry with you and spreading out to where it impacts a much, much larger group.
But how would it help them? See, that's my question.
Well, it does help them.
Well, if
it's
they're...
something that happens with time.
But if they're gone, why would they be... How would they be helped over time?
Well, because at that point when they die, you have the two items. You have their soul and you have their body. And obviously at the end of it, their body gets cremated or gets buried in a coffin and put down in the dirt. But their soul, the emphasis of who they are inside, that's what makes the movement. And that eventually, as they progress and get closer and closer to getting to heaven, they get reconnected with their body. Now, that's a bit hard to explain to some people that don't understand that or have not been exposed to it, but still.
Well, you have been exposed to it, because otherwise, presumably, you wouldn't be believing this.
I know you do,
but that would presuppose, I would think, that you've been exposed to these experiences that lead you to talk about a thing called a soul, a thing called heaven. What experiences, if you wish to say, have you had that lead you to speak about these terms and the way you do?
By doing the good that I do, lets me understand. And by doing the good that I do, and the good that I teach others and instruct others and show others and I do with others, this fills my heart. It fills my soul with the warmth and allows me to understand and helps me do what I'm doing, no matter how tired I am of this or that. It gives me that energy, and it recharges my batteries on a constant basis. There's the rain.
Indeed. I certainly have seen how your batteries have gone low and then been recharged, so I can't deny that you have, your energy is, you've described today, how you take fantastically long walks that I couldn't even imagine taking, you know, as a matter of course. So, I mean, that's a reality. I guess the question again, in which I to me is still unanswered, which has to do with your particular experience. I don't see how this has anything to do with soul or heaven, in terms of, in other words, what I ask you is, when you use these terms, do these relate back to a particular experience you had at a particular moment in your life that. It's true, you're saying that every time you do these good things, you feel energized. You feel,
yes.
You feel you're passing on something, and you're
very
also...
Very simplistic way of putting it. Yes, that's true.
You know, and energized not just in a, gosh, you know, I'm taking energy pills, but in a meaningful way that reassures and heals you.
It doesn't go, you know, and energize my body. It energizes my soul.
But you can
charged up.
You can talk about yourself as a combination of,
yes,
of whatever you are. It energizes that of you. And so you're defining part of yourself as this part of this term soul.
Yes. Yes.
And what experience have you had with this particular aspect of yourself that you wish to comment on, if you do? It's a personal sort of thing. You're dealing with an atheist here. So, I mean, that might not be the kind of thing you might want to talk about. But if you did, here's your big chance.
Well, we lead good lives. We extend ourselves beyond our own little warm bubble of life, because if we're only taking care of ourselves and only accumulating stuff and things and riches, the key to it is one has to change their focus if they want to, a very simplistic way of putting it together is you want to work on your retirement benefits, if you think about this, and you put those emphasis on important things. Let me see what this call's all about.
You may be coming in with some more important things at this point. I've been talking with, because this man has to get back to work,
yeah.
Whether it's for the souls of others around him, for his own soul, or just to help people, body and soul. Any final thoughts, JC?
Well, you end up getting help because you're reaching out and giving to others your time, your efforts, your resources. It's in giving that you receive. And the more you give of yourself, your time, your sweat, and your energy, your dollars, whatever it happens to be, you give it away. It's not just a matter of giving it away, but putting it in a better place. This helps other people and allows them to move along in a better situation.
And some people can completely agree with that and have no conception of an afterlife, heaven, or the soul, you know.
Well, it'll catch up with them at some point. Whatever is happening, and hopefully they have enough brownie points that they are able to make that step forward from life to death to afterlife. Give that some thought. It might shake you up a little bit, but after you have examined that a bit and explored it a bit and said, well, wow, maybe I ought to give that a shot.
We'll have to talk further. Thank you. We've been talking with?
Okay. JC.
Thank you, JC.
Okay. Take care, Robert.
You too, man.
Suffering from malnutrition, and I say that we don't want no nuclear war. With nuclear war, we won't get far. No, I say that we don't want no nuclear war. With a nuclear war, we won't get far. Can't take no more. We can't take no more.
And that was Peter Tosh, No Nuclear War. So my regular expeditions up to Berkeley almost always involve J.C. Orton, because he's the... There we go. He's the main distributor, or the distributor, of Street Spirit for the Bay Area. And Street Spirit, this issue, had an unusual number of articles that attracted my interest. One of them is the Berkeley Vehicle Dwellers Win Settlement in Court. And I'm going to read you some of that now. But if you want to look at some of the other articles in more depth, I suggest you check out Street Spirit, which you can buy from the occasional homeless vendor in Santa Cruz. There aren't many of them. Two regularly attend Huff meetings, and there is usually an issue in the Berkeley Library. At least I left one there today. And you can also get one by contacting me on the Huff line at Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And most of the articles in this issue are available online, which is helpful, too, for all of you computer-savvy folks, which is a large majority of housed people these days. And that's some of you out there, for sure. Anyway, I'm going to read a bit of this. This was an article written as a commentary by Berkeley Copwatch, and it's called Berkeley Vehicle Dwellers Win Settlement in Court. The group's victory will change the city's municipal code. Still, anti-homeless parking laws persist. After a year of litigation, 10 Berkeley residents who live in vehicles have won a settlement from the city. The settlement makes two small but significant changes to Berkeley's municipal code, both of which have the potential to improve quality of life for people who live in vehicles. This win is a part of a larger wave of unhoused people across California using the courts to defend the rights of unhoused people, a trend cited in an ACLU report last year titled Outside the Law, the Legal War Against Unhoused People. In Berkeley, after a huge crackdown by the city against residents living in their vehicles, 10 individuals from the Berkeley Friends on Wheels community chose to fight back with a lawsuit. The group did not have a lawyer. With some volunteer legal support, and this to me is very important, they studied up and represented themselves in court. In the weeks leading up to a sweep planned for September 30th, 2021, city outreach workers routinely warned residents that Berkeley would soon begin enforcing all applicable laws. The parking regulations in Berkeley, as we have written about before, make it almost impossible to live in a vehicle. While there was enforcement of these ordinances, it had slowed with the start of COVID-19. But by September 2021, officials were ready to crack down again, despite the fact that pandemic conditions continued. Under the threat of having their homes towed, 10 unhoused neighbors, residents of the Friends on Wheels vehicle community, filed a lawsuit against the city of Berkeley. The lawsuit cited constitutional rights violations, violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act, among others. After a year of litigation, the 10 plaintiffs of the Friends on Wheels lawsuit won a settlement with the city of Berkeley. While not all their demands were met, the lawsuit did effectively put a pause on vehicle evictions for over 6 months while the city was publicly challenged in court. Each plaintiff was afforded $1,500 to be used for vehicle home repairs and registration. The eventual settlement also included changes to the Berkeley Municipal Code. Through a carefully written and powerfully argued case, in addition to mountains of collected documents and testimony, the Friends on Wheels case made legislative change and moved the needle slightly away from anti-homeless policy. There were two changes to the Berkeley Municipal Code, the BMC, one of which was to repeal Chapter 12.76 on house cars. It stated that no person shall use or occupy or permit the use or occupancy of any house car or camper for human habitation within the city for more than 3 days in a 90-day period. That's Berkeley Municipal Code BMC 12.76.020. It's interesting because this code is quite reminiscent of what was used to go after food servers It's a state law that says you cannot serve food except out of a certified kitchen for a group of people outside for more than three times in 90 days, which, of course, Food Not Bombs and other groups working in Santa Cruz and other areas, many of us ignored because people needed to be fed and it was outrageous, obviously intended to deter the visible poverty being shown, which embarrassed politicians in the various cities where it was enforced. In any case, continuing with the story about the Berkeley Vehicle Dwellers and their victory, while people were rarely cited for this old municipal code, it was also vaguely written, meaning enforcement of the ban was historically selective, targeting poor and unhoused residents in Berkeley. The plaintiffs also earned a huge win with amendments made to BMC 14.40.120, the so-called oversized vehicle overnight ban, OVS, OSV. This ordinance banned the parking of oversized vehicles between the hours of 2 a.m. and 5 a.m., somewhat similar to the Santa Cruz ordinance, which failed to make muster at the Coastal Commission. And I'm not sure if the Berkeley ever took any of their issues to the Coastal Commission, their ordinances, though Berkeley is in part on the coast, or at least it's on the bay. So I don't know, it might be within the Coastal Commission's jurisdiction and require that there be public access, and so that ordinances that criminalize people who live in their vehicles deny them access to the coast. And that might have been a consideration. I don't know. Perhaps one of these days I'll learn whether they address that issue, the folks who are thinking of challenging the law or not. Anyway, this is an ordinance that banned oversized vehicles between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m. I think the one in Santa Cruz bans them from midnight to 5 or midnight to 6. But it has not been enforced. Both the earlier ordinance, the Richelle Noroyan ordinance, I call it, after the city council member who led the charge in 2015, and also the current ordinance, maybe we can call it the Donna Myers ordinance, I don't know, in Santa Cruz, which was put on hold because of lawsuits by the American Civil Liberties Union, Disability Rights Coalition, Democratic Socialists of America. I'm not sure if it was Lifeboat or one of the affiliated groups that also took the issue, at least appealed the issue to the Coastal Commission. Continuing with this court case in Berkeley, the ordinance was actually amended in 2019 to explicitly include RVs and campers, even though they are not classified as commercial oversized vehicles. This amendment attempted to redefine the definition of an oversized vehicle, an OSV, and as the plaintiffs argued, a local statute cannot define commercial vehicles, as this is a matter of California, that is, state, as distinguished from local law. The city regulates the movement of vehicles, but it cannot alter its statutory definition. It sounds like a legal nitpicking to me, but if it works, go for it. The city of Berkeley should have never been able to alter the OSV definition. Because of this lawsuit, Berkeley has been held accountable. Hence, it had to pay $1,500. There were some other, apparently, victories in the settlement. Why do these wins matter? When people living on the street are evicted from their spot and have their belongings dumpstered, they do not often have a chance to respond, to have their complaints heard, to hold the city government responsible. It is incredibly hard to find lawyers to take up a case. Filing all the necessary paperwork for a lawsuit when your rights have been violated requires transportation, funds, access to computer and internet, and lots of time, among other things. This makes it incredibly easy for city governments to get away with violating the rights of unhoused people without any accountability or repercussions. None of the plaintiffs have yet received the $1,500 vehicle repair and registration stipend. nor have any of the plaintiffs yet received coordinated entry assessment or reassessment as was agreed upon in the settlement. I think that means access to housing. That sounds like that's maybe what it means. Additionally, the harassment of the Friends on Wheels community, including more residents than just the 10 plaintiffs in this case, continues with additional four-hour parking signs posted on nearly every block in the area. On Tuesday, October 4th, 2022, in the early morning, four vehicles were towed as part of a larger effort by the city to purportedly, quote, clean, unquote, the area. What ensued was an eviction of many of the residents living in tents along 8th Street, north of Harrison Street in Berkeley. Two vehicle homes and two vehicles used for transportation to work were impounded. In the following days, as residents attempted to retrieve their vehicles, they were told by the tow yard that their vehicles, with their belongings still inside, had been destroyed as part of the agreement with the city. Unfortunately, the gains achieved from the recent settlement have not fundamentally changed the anti-houseless practices of the city of Berkeley and its so-called homeless response team. Get active. Be aware. Refuse to be abused. And that's by Berkeley Cop Watch. And it's, again, Berkeley Vehicle Dwellers win settlement in court. Group's victory will change the city's municipal code. Still, anti-homeless parking laws persist. And that's in Street Spirit of November 2022, which is available in the main library in Santa Cruz and online under thestreetspirit.com or .org. Try them both and see where you get. So this next musical break is compliments of the Byrds, singing group from the 60s. It's called I Come and Stand at Every Door. And I'm going to read you the lyrics, even though they're pretty intelligible. But just in case, I come and stand at every door, but no one hears my silent prayer. I knock and yet remain unseen, for I am dead, for I am dead. I'm only 7, although I died in Hiroshima long ago. I'm 7 now as I was then. When children die, they do not grow. My hair was scorched by swirling fire. My eyes grew dim. My eyes grew blind. Death came and turned my bones to dust, and that was scattered by the wind. I need no fruit. I need no rice. I need no sweets nor even bread. I ask for nothing for myself, for I am dead. For I am dead. All that I ask is that for peace you fight today, you fight today, so that the children of this world may live and grow and laugh and play.
I come and stand at every door, but no one hears my silent prayer. I knock and yet remain unseen, for I am dead, for I am dead. I'm only 7, although I died in Hiroshima long ago. I'm 7 now as I was then. When children die, they do not grow. My hair was scorched by swirling flame. My eyes grew dim. Death came and turned my bones to dust, and that was scattered by the wind. I need no fruit, I need no rice, I need no sleep.
So here's a story from the Disability Rights Advocates website. And they were, again, one of the plaintiffs who, well, they weren't really plaintiff, I guess, but they were the, I guess you call them, appellants. They appealed the OVO, the Oversized Vehicle Ordinance, along with the ACLU here in Santa Cruz, not in the courts, as I said before, but in the Coastal Commission, which so far has been good in at least holding off the technical enforcement of the Santa Cruz OVO law. But I'm hearing in Huff meetings that people are still getting tickets inside the coastal zone, even though the signs placed there have not been essentially passed by and given the imprimatur of legitimacy by the Coastal Commission, even the local Coastal Commission. And the local Coastal Commission says, we protest against this, but of course they're not doing any enforcement against the city to stop the harassment and the citation, and ultimately the seizure of vehicles that can't afford to pay fines. Anyway, in Sevastopol, there's an ordinance that's similar. They're trying to displace residents living in their vehicles. At least I'm assuming it's similar. Let's read what their website says. This is from the October 25th, 2022. Sevastopol is a city on the north coast above San Francisco. Today, ACLU Foundation of Northern California, Disability Rights Advocates, Legal Aid of Sonoma County, and the California Rural Legal Assistance, Inc. filed suit against the city of Sevastopol for enacting an ordinance that prohibits vehicles, quote, used for human habitation from parking anywhere within the city limits during the day. This action, aimed at driving the city's most vulnerable residents out of town, follows a decades-long and local and state failure to build affordable housing. Current listings for the smallest available apartments in Sevastopol approach an amount that is roughly equivalent to 100% of the monthly net income for a full-time worker making California's minimum wage. So you got to pay all your wage for a month in order to get rent at the smallest available apartment in Sevastopol, according to this. As a result, many long-term Sevastopol residents have been priced out of the fixed housing, even though they may need to remain in the city to be near their families, jobs, schools, healthcare providers, and support networks. Unlike similar bans in other cities, the Sevastopol ordinance isn't based on concerns about traffic safety or vehicle size. So, for instance, they've claimed in Santa Cruz that it's a traffic safety if you have an oversized vehicle because it blocks the view of people turning onto the street, or it blocks the view of a sign. This is usually presented without any evidence that it's ever caused any problems, but it's a nice pretext to hang the law on, in my view. And I think the Coastal Commission, I think that it was certainly argued by the ACLU and the Disability Rights Coalition, who were also, as I said, involved in this Santa Cruz suit against our OVO, I should say the City Council's OVO law. The argument was pointed out that there's no evidence that they've presented. They just make these flat assertions and they expect the Coastal Commission to go along with them. And indeed, the local Coastal Commission, apparently in the jockstrap, if you will, of the city's staff, did go along with them. And that was until it was also pointed out that this would ban access to 54% of the city from anybody parking any time of day in a large vehicle, which immediately made it untenable, even for those who were trying to work a way to get those damn homeless vehicles out of sight and out of town. So, anyway, the Sevastopol Ordinance, which says it targets vehicles designed or altered for human habitation, allowing police to enforce the ordinance in a discriminatory manner. Although the ordinance prohibits parking any vehicle in which a person could sleep, the city has made it clear they intend to enforce the ordinance only against people who are living in their vehicles or are considered otherwise undesirable. Sevastopol has not only failed to provide notice or guidelines for the police to prevent arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement, the city has made it clear that it intends to enforce the ordinance only against people who have been the subject of complaints or whom the police deem undesirable, while giving wealthier residents a pass. This is discrimination, plain and simple, said Alicia Roman, staff attorney at California Rural Legal Assistance. I have not looked at the pleadings in this case. I'd be surprised if the city attorney or whoever cooked up this ordinance was stupid enough to say, we're only going to be targeting wealthier residents. But that could be, in fact, what is being done by the wording of the ordinance without using an explicit wealth criterion. And maybe I'll look at that at some point in the future. In addition to being discriminatory, Sebastopol's ordinance is uniquely punitive and enacts a one-strike-and-you're-out policy that calls for confiscating and impounding people's only means of shelter with the, wait for it, first citation. The threat of suddenly losing one's shelter is immensely stressful to people already struggling to maintain stability in their lives. Instead of working with the homeless and providing a reasonable solution, Sebastopol came up with a draconian one to ban homeless people living in their vehicles from the city, said Michael Deegan, a former resident of Sebastopol and one of the plaintiffs in the case. That is, one of the people who's living in an RV or is impacted by this ordinance. As a result, I was forced to move to Santa Rosa, where I have been assaulted by people and harassed by police. Sebastopol should overturn their RV ban and find another solution that is more humane and reasonable. Sebastopol officials' actions have made clear that they are more concerned with driving unhoused residents out of the city than providing meaningful solutions. In 2021, the City Council passed a resolution declaring the existence of a, quote, homeless emergency, unquote. According to the council, the emergency was not the human tragedy of community members being forced to live in vehicles. Rather, it was the existence of these vehicularly housed residents that it was, quote, impacting adjacent property owners, neighborhood businesses, and the general public. Impacting, you see. Illustrating this is the fact that Sebastopol provides almost no shelters for residents experiencing homelessness. Options are even more limited for unhoused Sebastopol residents with disabilities because the city has failed to provide accessible facilities. Many people who have lost their homes have only one alternative to sleeping unsheltered on the street, living in their vehicles. Sebastopol cannot continue to pass the buck on the regional housing crisis by pushing people living in their vehicles into neighboring communities. This approach is both cruel and counterproductive. To solve homelessness, Bay Area cities must work together to facilitate housing development and provide services and safe shelter to the unhoused, said Justin O'Milligan, homelessness prevention attorney at Legal Aid of Sonoma County. I can't disagree, but I'm not sure what that is going to do. Thomas Zito, supervising attorney at Disability Rights Advocates, said Sebastopol's failure to provide adequate affordable housing for its residents has disproportionate risk for our clients and others like them who are low-income people with disabilities who have been forced into housing of last resort, their vehicles. Living in an RV, car, or trailer is often much safer for people with disabilities than congregate shelters or living in a tent. Sebastopol cannot solve its housing crisis by driving unhoused people with disabilities out of town. And I'm not aware, for example, that in the recent Benchlands removal, which displaced hundreds and hundreds of people, there was any provision for people with disabilities up at the Armory and up at the Overlook next to the Armory, which was the go-to shelter that gave them the excuse, which claimed that they were providing alternatives, and so they were not, they said, the city of Santa Cruz said, violating the Martin versus Boise court decision that says don't give them a ticket, don't prosecute them unless you have some kind of, and don't move them from where they are, unless you have some kind of real offer of alternative shelter that isn't discriminatory and is accessible and is indoors. Santa Cruz didn't have that. They lied about it. They did it anyway. And the entire Benchlands was demolished and now is a barren area with people sleeping wherever they can hide out. Or I guess their feet are sometimes poking out. Sebastopol's ordinance, getting back to Sebastopol, unlawfully attacks its most vulnerable residents, those who, because of economic circumstances and the city's own policy failures, have been forced to seek shelter by living in vehicles, said Walter Freeman, senior counsel of the ACLU of Northern California. It is not permissible for a city to address the crisis of homelessness by attempting to force unhoused people out of town. And that, again, is a from the web page of the disability rights advocate. Civil rights groups sue the city of Sebastopol for the ordinance aimed at displacing residents living in their vehicle. So here's a bit more detail about this, the complaint that is being filled out. And we'll hopefully be seeing some complaints the next time the police move on anybody or threaten to move on anybody who are in, who is encamped in Santa Cruz. When they're not offering them adequate shelter, as is almost invariably the case. This case in Sebastopol involved David Allen Yesu, Michael W. Deegan, Paige, Elitza Corley, Jessica Marie Wetch, and the Sonoma County Acts of Kindness organization. Plaintiff Michael W. Deegan is 66 years old, currently lives in an RV outside of Sebastopol. He was previously employed as a commercial driver, but lost his license several years ago. If you're wondering what that sound is in the background, I'm actually downloading this complaint and the lawsuit just to make it available to those who want to read it and who don't have this kind of online opportunity that I do. Mr. Deegan has several disabilities, including a serious knee injury, severe depression, and other mental health disabilities and health conditions that put him at increased risk of complications from COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. Because these disabilities prevent him from working, he currently lives on only $1,167.20 per month in benefit payments, far too little to afford fixed housing in Sebastopol. As a result, his RV is the only shelter available to him and the only place where he can maintain his belongings and feel safe. He moved to Sebastopol from Santa Rosa in 2018, living in an RV on Laguna Parkway and on Morris Street, was routinely harassed by police. He left Sebastopol after the passage of the HHV ordinance because he could not risk living there due to the threat of being ticketed and having his RV towed. I think that's the ordinance. They're talking about the oversized vehicle ordinance, perhaps. Mr. Deegan has a disability-related need to live in his RV rather than on the streets of Sebastopol or in a congregate shelter because of his mental health conditions and vulnerability to COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. He cannot live in a congregate setting, and he would be at a particular risk if forced to live unsheltered on the street. Living independently in his RV allows Mr. Deegan to manage his mental health conditions to protect himself from infectious disease. Losing the shelter, safety, and security his RV provides would be devastating to Mr. Deegan's physical and mental health. And this, of course, is a significant consideration here, this being at least one of the things that was mentioned here was the COVID crisis. The fact that these two prestigious legal organizations that are afraid of losing cases. They don't want to lose cases for various reasons. They're wasting their time and money. They're, of course, hurting their clients. And also they're creating a bad precedent, if they do, for possibly other people, other homeless folks in, who are living in RVs who are being harassed elsewhere in the state or elsewhere in the 9th district, which is the most of the western states, the far western states. So the fact that they're taking the case, even as COVID is ending, and they're still using the COVID-19 argument, among other things, means that that is still an argument that is they consider it viable. And that is one of the reasons that activists in Santa Cruz who had declarations and who had the opportunity to file in the benchland said they didn't want to do it because the COVID crisis is over, so they can't claim that COVID is a problem anymore. Well, that's not, in fact, the case. I mean, there are a lot of us who are skeptical of the dimensions of the COVID scare, who are skeptical of vaccines. Some are skeptical of vaccines. Some are skeptical of mandatory of COVID vaccine mandates. But still, the reality is that insofar as this is still considered a health emergency, then the city and the county and the police departments are supposed to abide by it. And so are the attorneys, at least, to acknowledge that. And that's been one of, I've been really concerned that a lot of declarations have been gathered by the California Homeless Union and then not used. That really pissed me off. It still does, somewhat. So what some of us are doing at the Huff, which we don't claim to have the resources the Union of the Homeless has or that other groups may have, but we do, we have been trying to gather together people who are willing to make the kinds of complaints that Michael Deegan makes here in Sebastopol and take that to an attorney or just take it directly. You don't need an attorney. You can file it yourself if you have, if you simply put it out and fill out the proper papers. And that's something that some Huffsters have been working on. But with the demolition of the benchlands, the problem is, and the failure of the city to actually act on specifically anti-homeless laws that are narrowly tailored to go after homeless people or particularly focused on homeless people, we don't have the same kind of target. So, for example, if you have a law that criminalizes homeless people, there actually is such a law. It's the camping ban in Santa Cruz called the Camping Services and Standards Ordinance. And, of course, the oversized vehicle ordinance as well, which isn't being enforced. But the city isn't using that ordinance. It is instead using it is simply frightening people by threatening to take their property and then doing so, as you saw in the benchlands repeatedly, even though it doesn't give them adequate alternatives, and doing so without just violating straight state law. So I suppose, and it's been said by angry activists who are wondering why activists like myself and the Union of the Homeless People and, I don't know, Love Boat and Disability Rights Coalition, ACLU, Democratic Socialists of America aren't taking some action simply because there's certainly massive claims about and perhaps certainly some documentation of loss of property in these sweeps, which happened quite publicly and quite systematically by Larry Imwale and his boss, Matt Huffaker, the Santa Cruz city manager. In violation of state law that specifically says you got to hold property for a period of time. It's 2 months or 3 months, and it's not being done. They're just dumpsterizing it. They're saying either you move everything immediately within a week, as they said this 8 different times to 8 different groups of camps in parts of the benchlands encampment, and then they destroyed all property that remained after the deadline. Even though they forced people to leave the area and didn't allow them to come back and take their property, which is quite well documented. And you've heard about it on my show as well. Another plaintiff is Elitza Corley, 25 years old, a resident of Sebastopol. She grew up in the foster care system, according to the complaint, which exposed her to a great deal of instability, trauma, and violence. As a result of significant trauma, she has mental health disabilities in the form of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, depression, and anxiety, which makes it impossible for her to live in a congregate setting. She moved to Sevastopol in 2021 to take care of the son of a friend who later passed away. She has found a sense of community in Sevastopol and wishes to continue to live there, but cannot afford to rent on the income she earns from a series of part-time jobs. She previously lived in a vehicle on Morris Street and other locations in Sevastopol and is currently living at the village. Prior to moving into the village, her RV was ticketed and she was threatened with towing on multiple occasions. If the village closes, I assume that's an RV encampment perhaps, She will have no choice but to leave Sevastopol because she cannot live there in a vehicle under constant threat of being ticketed and having her vehicle and all her possessions taken from her. Ms. Corley has a disability-related need to live in his RV. I guess it means her RV if we're talking about a Ms. than on the streets of Sevastopol or in a congregate shelter. Her mental health disabilities make it impossible for her to live in a congregate setting around unfamiliar people. Having the private, safe space of her own that her RV provides allows her to manage her PTSD, anxiety, and depression, and protects her from the violence and harassment she would likely be exposed to as a young woman living in a congregate setting or alone on the street. Losing this shelter and safety would dramatically worsen Ms. Corley's mental health disabilities. And since attorneys, as I said, of these fancy organizations, ACLU and the Disability Rights Coalition and Legal Aid, are willing to, you know, invest and spend a lot of time and money on these kinds of cases, it shows that simply anxiety and PTSD and conditions of this kind, which numerous people have who are in the benchlands, could, you know, could be used in a similar way there to you and in the future, where when police go after people in Santa Cruz, as they surely will, when complaints start coming in that the nervous Nelly Vanilla types want to have no homeless people in their neighborhood and don't want to be supporting what they call produces a magnet effect, to have other homeless people rushing in to serve, to experience some of the more wonderful harassment that folks are getting. If people think that living in the benchlands was a wonderful experience, they really should talk to some of the people who lived there. And I say that not because I'm attacking the right of people in the benchlands to maintain themselves there until they found something better, but to indicate that some critics would tell you that, oh, we're just supporting all these lazy, layabout, junkie types, these alcoholics, these people who made bad life choices, and now we have to pay for them. And of course, the irony is the payment that is being done is much more expensive by driving people out to different places. So anyway, this all came, I got this, sort of was directed to this case by a section in the Street Spirit newspaper, the current one that I encourage people to take a look at, titled Sevastopol CA City Bans RVs on City Streets for 15 Hours a Day. Now Advocates Are Suing. And I read you extensive stuff on that. And let's take another musical break.
Preach you a sermon about old man Adam, and I don't mean Adam in the Bible, datum. I don't mean Adam that Mother Eve mated. I mean that thing that science liberated. Einstein says he's scared, and if Einstein's scared, boy, I'm scared. Well, if you're scared of the A-bomb, here's what to do. You got to join with all the people in the world with you, because if we don't get together and do it well, first thing you know, we'll blow this world to... Moral as plain as day. Old man Adam is here to stay. He's gonna stick around, it's plain to see. But ah, my dearly beloved, are we? We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men may be cremated equal. You know, life used to be such a simple joy. The cyclotron was just a super toy. Folks got born, they'd work and marry, and Adam was a word in the dictionary. Then it happened. These science guys from every clime, they all pitched in with overtime. Before you knew it, the job was done. They'd hitched up the power of the doggone sun, put a harness on old Sol. Splitting atoms right and left, while the diplomats were splitting hairs. Of course, the cartel crowd up and put on a show. They're gonna turn back the clock on the UNO. grab a corner on Adams and maybe extinguish every darn atom. Can't speak English, down with hard-born Adams. America for American Adams. Step right up, folks, and atomize world peace. But the Adams International, in spite of hysteria, flourishes in Utah, also Siberia. Whether you're white, black, red, or brown, the question is this, when you boil it down, to be or not to be. That is the question. Adams to Adams and a dust to dust. If you listen to the money bag, something's bound to bust. Yes, it's up to the people, cause the Adam don't care. You can't fence him in, he's just like air. He don't give a darn about any politics or who got what into whichever fix. All he wants to do is sit around and have his nucleus bombarded by neutrons. Now, the answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there fustest with the most is atoms, but the people of the world must decide their fate. We gotta stick together or disintegrate.
And that was Talking Atom by Pete Seeger from the album Power to the People Protest Songs from probably the 50s or the 60s, maybe even the 40s. So this next interview is with Michael Oren, who is known perhaps, he's known more familiarly as, you might know him, as Dreamcatcher. And he's a someone I regularly get interviews with, and I kind of want to, kind of been following him over the years, so to speak, or at least occasionally running into him. And I ran into him today at the town clock, where he's the son of a community that gathers during the Food Not Bombs meal. And kind of clustering on the outskirts are also some, I wouldn't call them shelters or tents. They don't like to be called that, partially because it's an invitation to a police sweep, perhaps. But in any case, he talks about the aftermath of the Benchlands demolition Tuesday before last, which would have been on Tuesday, the 1st of November. So here he is.